This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. In 2006, James Chassie was brutally killed by Portland police. A documentary film about the killing was directed by Brian Lindstrom and produced by Jason Renault. We'll remember James Chassie, or Jim Jim, as we listen to his parents, friends, and eyewitnesses to the killing from the film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie.
My mother-in-law was a nurse, and she says it was the kind of a labor and delivery where the mother or the baby or both would not have survived 50 years ago. And I often think it was a precursor to the troubled life and horrible death that Jim had. He was colicky. He was a very high-strung baby, hyperactive. But he was very bright, very loving.
James had a pretty good childhood from my standpoint. I think he was happy. He got to do a lot of things that he wanted to do. We hiked. He liked that. He liked camping, nosing around in the woods.
He enjoyed school up until the time, I think, that he went to junior high school.
His grades and his interest in school just fell like a rocket. And I kind of looked at it like, well, that's the way kids are. This high school thing was something else. It was just like running into something out of Dickens for him. It just was not a culture he could cope with.
My connection with Jim was the band we were in together back in summer of 79. He was a natural performer. Some performers, they have that gift of being able to grab people's attention. It was almost like kind of an energy, like an aura.
There was some unexplainable glow or spirit that you could see that this kid had it going. He was finding his bliss.
This is a hot number, folks.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, it's very unusual that a young person decides that they're going to put out a magazine and thinks the world might be interested in it and illustrates it and shows it to people as his legitimate work.
Little reviews he'd do of shows that he'd seen. I remember one, he couldn't get into the show because he was under 21, so he stood outside and asked people who were coming out of the show, "What did you think of the show?" There'd be a review of the band and then a drawing of them because he didn't have a camera.
He was trying to encourage people. He wanted other people to be creative too. I want to die young. I'm so ugly, feel so down. No, Mr. Lifeguard, please let me drown.
He was totally getting off on his own work. He just thought it was wonderful.
Silent Snow, Secret Snow by Jim Jim. Crush my radio, wreck my TV. Oh no, what'll I do? I see snow. Snow in my room, snow in my room. Reality stays away from my door. I just can't relate anymore. The mailman doesn't come anymore. Took the telephone off the hook. On my bed, I see snow. What'll I do? Oh no. Snow in my room, snow in my room. Silent snow. Secret snow. Reality is my only foe.
He could make a comment and really just cut to something that was both humorous and ironic. He was a guy that you'd think he's going to write some great poetry, he's going to do some great art, he's going to grow up and make movies.
Once in a while you would see just the tension on his face, that he was dealing with inner demons, and you had to learn not to take it personal. And the other thing is you had to learn not to try and touch him, you know, like, hey, high five, Jim, because he didn't touch.
He was packing his things in boxes, and we asked him what he was doing, and he said he was going to move downtown with a friend of his. We tried to reason with him and tell him that he belonged in school and living with his family, and he was only 14 years old, and he wouldn't hear any of our advice. So I knew of a psychiatrist to call, and I called him, and he seemed to think Jim was having problems and should be evaluated. Jim was crying out, "The ghosts are chasing me, the ghosts are chasing me."
He had a suitcase that he had sealed with wax and pins and needles. He was trying to keep these demons inside of the suitcase, and he kept it under his bed. So he was frightened all the time. He walked in front of a bus, and a car came around and hit him. He jumped off the Broadway Bridge. Jim was going to kill himself. I didn't know how to stop him, and he didn't know how to stop him. And then when he told me that he was living in hell, he said, "Help me, help me." And it was like, we've got to do something.
He lived in several different foster group homes, but he wasn't real happy in that situation. His ultimate goal was to live independently. He finally got his wish, and the mental health people decided he could live independently. I think he sort of lived in his own little world. He was happy in his own little world. He loved art and music and taking hikes. He loved the simple things in life, like having an ice cream cone or writing a comic or going out to lunch with me. I think he must have gone to the Multnomah County Library practically every day that it was open. He just loved to go there. He told me that he was writing comic books, and he said he would leave them at the public library for people to enjoy. And he was having a great time doing comic books again. He loved Powell's bookstore, liked the little coffee shop attached to it. That would be his ideal situation if he ran into an old friend and could have tea or coffee and talk. He loved that.
He was very quiet, sort of a studious kind of fellow. His behavior was exemplary. I never heard of anybody having any kind of argument or harsh word with him or anything.
Those of us that knew James felt like he was definitely not a person that should have had an engagement with the police.
I used to see him about once every week or every 2 weeks. He'd call me when he was in a mood to do that. But he used to be included in all the family holidays, and we all saw him, but it was always on Jim's terms. He would do fine as long as he took his meds. But if he went off his meds, it would mean he needed hospitalization, and it would be very difficult. Mostly he just had stopped caring for his appearance and his hygiene. That was a dead giveaway. Jim was never like that before. Jim was in a bad shape. He needed to be hospitalized again. We felt he had gone off his meds.
This is Detective Lynn Courtney, Portland Police Bureau. Today's date is September the 20th, 2006. I'm in a detective division conference room on the 13th floor of the Justice Center with Portland Police Officer Christopher Humphreys, and he is present with his attorney.
And I noticed subject I later identified as Mr. Chassie, James Chassie. He caught my attention initially because he disheveled. I just assumed he was probably transient. He was standing with his back to me. It was really strange. He was doing this like stepping side to side movement with his feet. Stiff legged, very rhythmic.
So we were like, that's probably a good guy to talk to. He's acting peculiar. There's a lot of transient activity, drug activity.
Deputy Burton says, "Hey, you."
He turned and looked very frightened. Eyes opened up. And his posture became very rigid.
10 years of being a police officer, and I've never seen anybody look at me like that with the sheer terror in their eyes. I'll never forget seeing that face, and I knew he was gonna run.
It was kind of a regular day. It was warm, good fall day. I was working at Blue Hour. It's a restaurant, the Pearl, right on the corner of 13th and Everett. I was a bartender.
I was in Portland to visit my friend Randall Stewart.
It was an unexpected moment of chaos in a very orderly area of town.
I looked up just as the four men were hitting the pavement.
The sound first and foremost, was extraordinary.
Saw the officers tackle James.
Jim and the three involved officers were all on the ground.
They were trying to get him to lay down, face down.
It literally looked like two people shaking out a rug.
He was clearly very frightened.
I saw knees to the chest, punches to the face.
The officers kicked him.
The officer behind him was striking downward at him.
And slapped him upside the head.
A haymaker, what we call, when you're just bringing your arm all the way back and bringing it down on something with the full force.
He's clearly not a dangerous person, he's a frightened person.
Jim was not someone who needed to be confronted with this force.
And what is this?
Then I started hearing click, 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 which was the taser.
He was passed out.
What seemed to be 3 to 5 minutes.
The two officers shared just a glance at each other of, oh no. That's when I started pleading with people, again, take some pictures here, take some pictures.
After a few minutes, I wondered if he was dead.
The next day, I typed up police arrests and Pearl. First thing that came up was a webpage. It had a picture of James Chassie. He said he died in police custody en route to the hospital, that he had convictions on him. Basically, he was a bad guy. That's the webpage that sparked me to do everything. Okay, this guy died in police custody. Doesn't matter if he had convictions or whatnot, or if he had drugs on him. He was killed by police in broad daylight.
Matt Davis from the Portland Mercury said they received an email.
We got an email the morning after it happened from the barman who'd been working in the restaurant right opposite. We sat down and he brought out his cell phone and he said, oh, I got these pictures.
The image is really striking. It shows Jim passed out on the sidewalk. All of the police officers and safety officers and fire people are gathered around, kind of slightly distant from him, slightly apart from him. They really don't look interested in him at all. Meanwhile, you know, to any onlooker, there's this pretty obviously suffering person sat in the middle of the street there. And the cops are drinking Starbucks coffee. It just communicated how callous a system can be towards an individual human being.
Deputy Dwayne Bagone of the coroner's office came with a nurse from Calroga Terrace where I live. He just says, James Chassie Jr. is no more. And he said that Jim had gotten into an altercation with the police and Jim had lost his life. And he talked about a lot of broken ribs. And he said that perhaps when the police were giving him CPR, the ribs had gotten broken. But it sounded to me like he had been beaten to death.
They had had medics come to check James out.
There was one female paramedic who was attending to Chassie.
That gave me as a witness some hope, that there was some hope in this.
I believe that they called him because they felt like he was not responding to them, that he may have passed out.
And at that point, a cry emerged from Jim.
No, don't leave me. Don't leave me. Don't leave me with these people.
No, come back. Don't go.
Please don't go.
They said that they did vital signs. They found the vital signs to be normal. Then they left. It is my opinion that if he had been transported to the hospital at this point, that he would have had a long recovery, but he probably would have survived.
The Chassie family has endured much heartache since James Chassie died. And for this, I am truly sorry. I personally feel the need to apologize when anyone dies in police custody, regardless of the circumstances. And I apologize to the Chassie family.
At that point, we were only a few weeks into the crisis. This will be fine. This will be fine. We will tell the truth. And then I'll wait for the newspaper or the news to say, okay, the public figured it out.
Every question was, how'd the fall look? They were trying to get the words out of me that the fall is what gave him the injuries that led to his death.
One of the PPP officers sort of did like a flying tackle.
He hit his head hard.
Screaming.
In a pitiful way.
You know, don't kill me, don't kill me.
Mercy, mercy.
These were pretty big guys, and this guy wasn't very big.
He was very aggressive and very combative.
What I saw was excessive manhandling.
It looked like James tried to bite one of the officers.
An officer said, don't bite me.
And that officer kicked him a few times.
Hit him 3 times.
The officer behind him was kicking him in the back of the head, punching him in the face.
With a lot of force.
The taser was going off at the same time, and then seemed to be unconscious for quite a length of time.
This is really awful. This seems excessive.
Their job is really difficult. But I felt it was excessive.
I expect you have all received information from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office
that no criminal charges will be filed against either Portland police officer or the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office deputy in the in-custody death case of James Chassie.
I was gobsmacked because it felt so good. The grand jury day felt good. There we were. We were going to all tell what we knew, and we did.
The reality is when you have a person who is in flight mode and you have an officer whose duty is to catch that person, the result is not always pretty. The use of force is not pretty. The use of force is not something that looks good ever.
I've represented a lot of people over the years in police misconduct cases and a lot of families with people that they've lost due to a death at the hands of the police. I met with Mark and Jim's father, and within a few days, they made the decision to have me represent them in looking into the death of Jim.
He had run away when he was about 19 years old. He had been beaten up by the police, ended up in a mental hospital in Utah. I think from that time on, he had a terrible fear of the police.
Jim happened to be mentally ill, and he happened to get very scared when he saw the police and run. But he wasn't beaten because he was mentally ill, and the cover-up didn't happen because he was mentally ill. It happened because of who the police are and what the police get away with.
I do wholeheartedly believe, based on my conversations with Officer Humphreys, Deputy Burton, and Sergeant Nice, that all three of them will be cleared. I don't believe for a second that there was ever any ill intent on any of those three persons. I wholeheartedly believe that they were out there doing their job, trying to do it the best that they could. So I'm hoping that they're cleared, and I'm hoping that they can move on.
You said Officer Humphreys came up and tackled him?
I believe he wrapped both arms around the subject and just fell forward to the ground. It was just a straight bear hug type tackle.
We know that it's likely that the thing that killed Chassie was the crushing weight of an officer falling on him. So if Humphreys can tell internal affairs detectives that he in fact fell next to Chassie, he avoids implication in his death.
We are here with Portland Police Officer Christopher Humphreys, and he is present with his attorney.
I give him a really hard shove with my forearms on his back. As we're trained to do on foot pursuits, you either run up behind him and hit him in the back to try and kind of trip up their steps, and that's exactly what it did. I mean, it tripped up his rhythm, and I got maybe one step, and then I just went, boom, down right on the ground.
Did you fall on the sidewalk, not on him?
Yeah, or? I fell on the sidewalk. I went right over and past him.
You don't actually land on him in any way?
No. But straight after the incident occurred, Humphreys was telling his colleagues in the jail, I tackled him. I think when Humphreys told internal affairs detectives that he pushed Chassie and then fell to the pavement next to Chassie, I think he was lying. I think he fell on top of him, crushed him, and ultimately that's actually what killed him. I walk back to the area of the tree where Mr. Chassie had been standing. And I yelled to Sergeant Nice, it could be cocaine.
Sergeant Nice told me that he observed the suspect throw something as he was running. I think he assumed it was a crack or crack pipe.
Before you made this accusation out loud, in front of the audience, the people that were there, the bystanders, in front of the paramedics, that I found a rock of cocaine, did you look at it to see if, in fact, it fit the profile of cocaine?
I did.
And
I looked at it.
And you have training in that, don't you?
I do.
And you concluded at that time that it was cocaine. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Then why did you make that allegation?
Why did they yell out, I might have some cocaine here, when they found breadcrumbs in his Safeway bag? It's because they want the people to think that there was something wrong, that this person is a dangerous criminal, and that justifies the brutality that they just witnessed.
He was passed out.
Unconscious for a good 5 minutes.
Was out for 3 to 5 minutes.
Literally in a pool of his blood. I do remember thinking it was kind of weird that they were, like, tapping him with their foot.
After a few minutes, I wondered if he was dead.
Meanwhile, since they had him knocked out, they handcuffed him.
Hogtied him. That seemed really weird.
It got really somber, and the most amazing thing happened. Chassie kind of started coming to.
EMTs said that he was okay to go to jail. I think the question is, how could somebody who, at that point, probably had a bunch of broken ribs and might even have had a punctured lung be signed off on as being medically okay to go to jail?
Did you tell anyone what had happened? I'm talking about the AMR people or the firefighters.
I know I didn't advise about the going unconscious.
You did not tell them, did you, that Mr. Chassie had been tackled from behind by a 240-pound officer, did you?
No.
Did you indicate that Mr. Chassie had been knocked to the ground by you with two forearms and he landed hard on the ground?
No.
And that his chest hit the concrete with force?
No, I did not.
Did you indicate to them that anyone had punched or kicked or struck Mr. Chassie?
I don't recall, no.
Did you mention to the paramedic that you thought his shoulder was dislocated?
No, I did not.
I know it would be an issue that a taser had been used.
Did anyone say anything about Mr. Chassie being tased?
I don't recall if I did or not.
Can you imagine not telling the medical provider that you had tackled this person, the person that hit the pavement hard, that you'd struck the person repeatedly, that you'd tasered the person, not telling them that you saw someone either stop breathing or be unconscious for 30 seconds to a minute? Can you imagine not telling the medical provider that? It's incomprehensible that someone wouldn't, unless they didn't care or intended to cover up what was going on, that you wouldn't share that information with the medical providers.
His pulse was going like a race car. I don't think I've ever felt a pulse that fast.
She asked me any drugs or sign of drug use. I said, we might have some cocaine.
She'd said the police officers found cocaine.
The female ambulance driver said that he is probably high, but he is stable.
By not disclosing the physical force used, by not disclosing the lack of consciousness or the lack of breathing for 30 seconds to a minute, and by pointing the paramedics in the direction of drugs, the paramedics thought that he was under the influence of cocaine or some drug. And the fact that he wasn't very responsive, wasn't coherent, was a result of the drug use.
I asked what hospital we're going to go to. He kind of indicated that if the patient's vital signs were within normal limits, he's going to go to jail.
Twice, a female paramedic offered to transport, twice. And I said no for taking this guy to jail.
We had possession of controlled substance charge, felony assault on a police officer, a resist arrest. We had numerous charges. So without any specific reason or desire by an ambulance support taking the hospital, he was going to go to jail.
He was scared that he was going to be found out, along with the other officers, to have done something bad to Jim Chassie.
I clearly heard the female paramedic tell Officer Humphreys that the suspect's blood pressure and pulse were normal.
And I said, well, he's good to go. And she's like, yeah. She says, sign here.
They knew they had done something, too, they shouldn't have done. They may not have known how serious the problems were, but they wanted to get rid of this guy. And the way to really get rid of him and not have him looked at by medical people was to dump him into the jail, and hopefully he would then disappear.
When the paramedics packed up their bags, did Mr. Chassie yell, don't leave me, don't leave me?
He did, yes.
Yeah, but you heard him say, don't leave me.
I did.
That's pretty sad, isn't it?
The whole situation's very sad,
But sir. That's very sad, isn't it?
I just said the whole situation's very sad, sir.
Once he's in your patrol car, what happens next?
He's not screaming anymore, but he's doing this gibberish mumble. And I ask, what's your last name? And it was really strange. He mumble, Chelsea. So I go, okay, Mr. Chelsea, do you have a wallet on you? And he goes, I have a wallet. And the wallet is an ID for a James Philip Chassie. If I remember correctly, the identification had some, like maybe a library sticker. We brought him into jail. I remember I just get the handcuffs off and I realize he's gone unconscious again. I look over at the deputy and I said, we need to get medical. He passed out on us before.
He stopped breathing for the second time and he's gone into seizures, correct?
That's correct.
That's a change, isn't it?
I would believe so, yes.
Yeah. That's a significant change, isn't it?
Yes.
And did you kneel down, take that spit sock off so you could see whether his eyes were open to assess his vital signs?
I did not know.
You did not?
I did not.
The officers don't disclose to the nurses anything about prior use of force, prior medical problems.
You decided that you were going to take him to Portland Adventist Hospital.
That's correct.
And what did you estimate would be the time it would take?
15, 20 minutes maybe, somewhere around there.
So you have someone who has stopped breathing twice, who has seized, and you are going to transport him 15 or 20 minutes to a hospital?
Yeah, at that point, I mean, the medical unit at
the jail didn't seem to be, assume that if he would have been in serious distress per them, that they would have dealt with him, but.
Did you tell the nurses that he had stopped breathing once before?
No.
So they may not have had the complete picture.
That's correct.
You ever had a broken rib?
No.
Ever had a bruised rib?
Yes.
Painful?
Yes.
You agree that if Mr. Chassie had 12 or 16 broken ribs when you were carrying him around, that that would have been extremely painful for him?
That would have been painful.
And what's your sense of the noise? Is it anger? Is he in pain?
More of a defiant, angry noise. At no point during any of this did I feel like he was making noise in pain.
You don't think he ever was screaming?
I mean, it's just a choice of words, okay. You know, making that distinction. He was definitely, it was a yell. I like the word yell better.
But instead of putting Chassie into a ambulance, which is what he needed at this point, he was put back in the squad car. Humphreys and Burton stopped the squad car to talk to a sergeant on the way out. Apparently the sergeant wants to know what's going on. Instead of kind of saying, well, we can't stop to talk now, we've got to drive to the hospital, both of them get out to talk to the sergeant.
We pull out of the Sallyport. I'm still hearing him mumbling as we're going through town. We start to get on the freeway. And just as I roll up the window, I hear bonk. I can see that he's leaning up against the passenger side door. And then I realize, I can't tell if he's breathing or not. We gotta get off.
I turn my lights and siren on and proceed eastbound I-84, take the first exit we come to, which is 33rd.
Pull open the door, I pull off the spit mask.
He's not responding. He's unconscious. It's unclear if he's breathing at this point.
He's still handcuffed and he's still leg cuffed. I pull him out of the car, onto his back, right there on the sidewalk.
Patting him on the head, slapping him in the cheek, yelling his name, slapping the concrete next to his head.
James, wake up, James. No response, nothing.
It became pretty clear that he did not have a pulse at that point. I reached in and started pulling the blood out of his mouth.
I gotta get some oxygen to him, but I don't want to put my lips on his lips. And at that point, there's a bystander.
Asked if we would like to use a defibrillator.
I said, what do you need? And he says, I just need bare skin. And about that time, the machine goes, shock not advised. I told Burton, I'm like, no, he's dead. You're sitting there, begging him and God and everybody else, I'm trying to shove life back into him.
The City of Portland has reached a tentative settlement with the family of James Chassie. The total settlement amount of $1.6 million will come from the City of Portland's self-insured reserve and from our excess insurance carrier.
Maybe some good will come out of the case. What good that could come out of the case, I don't know. Maybe just that nobody else would ever have to go through what Jim went through.
This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. You have been listening to voices from the film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie. Thank you to film producer Jason Renault for permission to air this audio. Alien Boy is available on Amazon and can be viewed on Amazon Prime. You can listen to this program and a discussion about the film and how it relates to calls to reform and defund the police at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline.